On the show today, we yarn with Professor Peter O'Mara about many things, including his journey into medicine, his work as the president of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association, his connection with spirituality, and his special relationship with the Nunkari. We also talk about the impact of racism on the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, how they experience it in healthcare, and how this can cause potential barriers to accessing healthcare.
Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.
So on the show today, we've got the lovely Professor Peter O'Mara joining us from New South Wales. So Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. It's a privilege to be here.
So Peter, can you tell us who's your mob? Where you're from?
So I'm New South Wales. I'm a Wiradjuri man. So northeast Wiradjuri country is my family's land. Mudgee, Ralston, Glen Davis, all that way, and a lot of the Wallamai National Park, which is nice to have some of your significant sites in a country that's been protected, not destroyed.
Very important there. So Peter, you are a professor at a university, but you're also a doctor, one of the Indigenous doctors, and you've previously been the president of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. Can you tell me a bit about how you actually got into medicine?
I grew up in a small coal mining area in the Hunter Valley, and in Cessnock. I lived in a little town of Paxton of about 600 people. You know, the best job you could hope to get at that point as a young fellow would be a job in the mines. It paid really well, and back in those days, it was a really secure job as well. And so that's what I did. I was lucky enough to get a job in the mines. I done my apprenticeship as a fitter machinist, but I basically worked as a mine mechanic, and I did enjoy the work. And at that time, I was competitive bodybuilding and kickboxing, and I had a martial arts class, a self-defense class, and those kinds of things, and was enjoying life. And then I had a motor vehicle accident. A fella jumped the medium strip in what was a 100 zone back in those days, and basically hit me head on, and I sustained some injuries to my back. And I had about 6 weeks off where I just really couldn't do too much at all. And I went back to work. You know, part of my job was to carry a tool bag that weighed about 20 to 25 kilos on any given day. And I'd walk with gumboots on through mud underground for, you know, kilometres servicing the machine. And I really struggled to go back to that kind of work again. I had intense back pain, and I wasn't able to get straight back into my exercise as well, which had really significant complications for my spiritual kind of and emotional well-being, because I was getting angry a lot. And I'm not an angry person, but I just couldn't do that exercise to release the anger, and was trying to deal with all this pain. And so at that point, I realised that I had to do something else. I wasn't going to be able to continue the stuff that I was doing. So I looked around some other things, tried to do sort of an office kind of job for a while, dealing with life insurance for a particular company, and I was doing really well in that. Well, I was doing really well. And then I had a couple of cases where people who I had sold insurance to, like income protection insurance, had put in claims and they were rejected. And I was ringing up the company saying, what's happening here? And I just got so frustrated with these guys who I felt were corrupt. And so that really frustrated me. And I went back to sort of bouncing in that for a while, but yeah, standing out in front of clubs and things all night, and my back was aching. So I thought at that point, I'm going to have to do something different. I'm going to have to look for a job where I use my brain. So I thought I might do a matriculation course and get into university. The idea of doing psychology I found really attractive, to sit in front of someone and maybe help them out with some aspects of their lives. I thought that would be a great thing. At school, I was always good at science and always interested in how the body worked, but no one apart from my family, who, like your mum always said, whatever you want to do, you can do. You just got to work hard. But none of the teachers had ever sort of steered me in that direction. So I thought, that's interesting. But there's not a whole lot in it. And so I had that in the background. And then when I started doing psychology, I actually loved the neuroscience. I just couldn't get enough of it. Plus, I love the behavioural stuff too, where you can, you know, help people modify their behaviour to make their life better. But anyway, I was studying psychology. I did it. The matriculation course I did was a general one. There was no Aboriginal specific one around at the university at that time. It was called the Open Foundation. I didn't really enjoy that, although I struggled a little bit with spelling and those kinds of things. And so one day I was at home studying for exams, and I'd studied all morning. My eyes were red and burning. I thought, I'll have a break. And I made myself a sandwich and sat down. I put the television on, and the Ray Martin show, the midday show, back in the old days, was on. Ray Martin was interviewing the first two Aboriginal doctors to ever graduate from the University of Newcastle, which was Lewis Peachey and Sandy Eads. And I was just like, what? They're Aboriginal doctors? I was just taken right back from it. And then I heard them being interviewed, and I thought, they're just normal people. And that really, I thought, wow, I reckon I could do this. I need to give it a go, you know. And so I sat my exams, and then as soon as I finished my exams, I went straight around to what was the faculty, the school at that, in those days, and got all their pamphlets and everything, and just knew every word in them, and applied to medicine. The rest is history, in a sense. I felt privileged as a student to be able to do that. Part of my struggle with as a student, I was only talking to our dean of medicine about this a couple of days ago, is when I was a student, I felt like I was being given all this information, and I was really honoured and privileged to be in that position, but I didn't feel like I was in a position to be able to give back enough, you know. I was a treasurer of the local land council and those kinds of things, but I wanted to be able to give back in a greater way, and I wasn't really in a position to, which is one of the things we want to turn around for our students to help, you know, with the skills that you're learning, contribute back to the community. Of course, once you graduate as a doctor, you get to do that, and it's really enriching. And, you know, part of that is, you know, I still drive to work, you know, particularly on clinical days or on days where I'm going to catch up with students. And I think I'm a doctor, and it's like I can't believe it. I just go, wow, I'm actually a doctor, and I've been a doctor for a long time. But I still feel really privileged and honoured, and sort of in some ways can't really, it doesn't really sink in.
Yeah, I exactly have the same feelings. And I think a lot of us, when we get into medicine, I mean, I always tell the story about, you know, I felt like I was in the Top Gun Academy and I was the fat drunk pilot in the corner with that real shitty plane that had like a propeller that you had to like start with your hand. And I was here with like Ace and Mongoose and, you know, they were all like the top of the top. And I was just like this, like, like sitting there. And I remember being in shock, like, holy shit, how did I even ask my way in here? And then again, what a privilege and what an honor. And I remember my first year of med school, another Aboriginal student and myself, we went out to Alice Springs. That was our first time out there when we were students, and we were members of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. It was just such an amazing conference to be in, to be around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander doctors, people who've got through, people like yourself, Peter. And, you know, it was such an inspiration for us as little medical students to go, oh my God, look at these people who are just doing such amazing things in the community. So I feel like there's a lot of informal mentoring that goes on when we all gather together.
As an older man now, I'm still always inspired by the students. You know, I hear some of the statements that they make and I think, wow, like, you're all over this stuff. They're just super smart, and to have the right attitude, you know, what I believe is the right attitude, that real community focus and stuff. I'm just constantly inspired by them. Part of your story about the aeroplane and the Top Gun thing reminds me a bit, yeah, I think we do have a bit of a sense of that imposter syndrome. I do remember years ago, I used to have this recurring dream, you know, maybe every couple of weeks, that I rarely have now. And it was like, I'm been privileged enough to do all these amazing things, you know, around the country and around the world and everything. And then I realized, oh, I didn't pass my final year exams. I didn't sit them. And then I go, oh no, what am I going to do? And then they say, oh, Peter, we'll allow you to sit them. I'm not going to pass them things. I haven't studied that. You know, years ago, I was in a room full of doctors who I had absolutely, you know, a huge amount of respect for. Those people like Noel Heyman, Mark Winnow, Alex Brown, Nia Brown, and all of these amazing doctors. And I told them that story, and they were going, oh, yeah, we all have that. And here I was thinking of these people who I absolutely have so much respect for have the same thing. And I don't have that dream anymore, apart from when I'm talking to students who are sitting exams, then I get it. And I think I'm starting to channel their anxiety.
Yeah, you're feeling it for them. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah, and it comes back again. And I always know, and when it happens, I think, oh, I know why that's there. I'm talking to these guys and I really want them to get through their exam.
Peter, you're such an inspiration to a lot of people around the nation and internationally as well. And particularly, I think your leadership in the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. You had the privilege of having me on the board with you, so I'm sure that we only got sent out of the room once for laughing. So
I think you've been in trouble a couple of times. So you don't mean it that bad, has it?
Led you astray. What was the most something that really sticks with you from that period of time where you were leading the doctors? I mean, for me, when I was a student director,
advocating for all of our Indigenous medical students, that was a big privilege for me. So I can't imagine what it would be like or feel like to, you know, being able to advocate at that sort of higher level, like government level, with all the different organisations, what it feels like to provide a voice in that space.
When I think about those times, I just think about how, again, privileged I was to be a part of such an amazing team. We had an incredible board, an absolutely super standout CEO. Our staff were all passionate and they just wanted to make a difference. And I just felt really honoured to be part of a team like that, and a team who respected, you know, overall, a team who all respected our connections with our ancestors and our spirituality and all of those things. It wasn't just, you know, we're in this Western world, bang, 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 and do this stuff. We kept coming back to who we really are, and that was our strength in the end. Because I think as an organisation, when you're out there with government and stuff, you know, I often hear the phrase that, you know, most people are born with rights, whereas, you know, Indigenous people are born with responsibility, and you know, we carry that. But that's also something that really warms you as well. And I just think that, you know, that team was just amazing and inspiring to me. And I reflect back on those. So I did feel a bit of pressure because we want to absolutely do the very best we can for our people. And during the COVID thing, I think I had a little bit of a almost like a midlife crisis, because, you know, we'd been told, you know, and we made some big changes, and Indigenous people are continuing to make big changes in policy and with government and major organisations, and that's really good. But, you know, we were told for so long, although as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we knew we had some solutions because we were in touch with our communities and what was happening on the ground. And you often get told, oh, there's no funds for that, there's no money for that, there's no money for this, you know. And then when the COVID stuff happened, you see the government putting money everywhere, and they should. And look at and they've done a great job around that leadership. And you look at the position that we're in compared to a lot of the world at the moment, and thankfully they did all those right things. But I thought, you know, we were told for years there was no money for almost anything that we needed to do, and look at all this money flowing, you know. And I thought, wow, I felt like I'd be lied to for a long time. And like I say, I'm not negative about the coronavirus response. It's absolutely what we need to do, and I'm proud to be in a country who took it so seriously. But you think, oh, you know, you just get fed that stuff all the time. People don't necessarily want to listen, and they resort to, oh, there's not really any money. And I've seen over the years too, you know, $1 million splash off here and $1 million splash off there at the whim of a minister. And the money may go to an area where, you know, is not going to make any sense, but someone's been ill-informed, so the money goes in that direction. And that's a challenge for us, because we know, you know, we have insight and we're in touch with our communities. We know it's going to make a difference.
And that's right. And I feel like the consultation with community is stuff that's really paramount. And I think, you know, with government over the years, there used to be the complaint like, oh, we set up housing and we give Aboriginal people houses and they've got stoves and they rip the stove out because they don't want to cook on a stove, you know, like all of those sorts of things. But they didn't actually go in and ask the, you know, community what it is that they want. How can we help you spend this money, or, you know, what, you know, that's that consultation process. And even myself in the work that I do with cultural immersions, it's sometimes a 2-year lead-in before I actually get in to run an immersion. I've got to go out and sit down with the elders. We have a yarn, we have a cup of tea, we have a chat, we get a feel of the place. We don't want to do anything that's disrespectful. So, you know, and I think the hurriedness of government sometimes and the pressures that they're experiencing, it's like, as you said, a flash in the pan. Look, let's throw some money at it. So like, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, well, you know, let's dig to the zag and move somewhere else.
Also, there's a challenge of government having short-term cycles. You know, a lot of decisions are made about the next election and getting re-elected rather than someone, you know, making those hard decisions. Hey, like, we just got to fix this. You know, let's get in and do this. And, you know, I know a lot of things, you know, when close the gap, that kind of stuff gets bipartisan support, and absolutely it should. You know, I wonder if that voice is being listened to enough in all of those spaces as well.
So, Pete, that leads me to one of the questions that I wanted to talk to you about around healthcare and the effect of colonialism. So this idea of this patriarchal viewpoint, I'll tell you what to do, what's best for you, blah, 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 blah. And we know that times are changing, and we're talking to our students and registrars a lot more around, you know, the holistic model of health and how, you know, everything's integrated. You know, we have an idea around emotional health, spiritual health, mental health, physical health. So all of those things are equally as important. So when you were going through, as a young man going through medicine, what have you experienced or observed with this idea of colonialism or even racism in health?
There always has been significant racism, even at a level that's just silly. You know, we heard other, thankfully I was in a university where we had other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students and we used to look after each other. And you'd hear stories about, oh, every Christmas we get free Reeboks and Nike kind of shoes, that kind of stuff, that if we bought a four-wheel drive, we'd make one payment on the car and you didn't pay any more to government of Paris. All that, absolutely, you know, and it ends up being a bit soul-destroying. And I think one of the really important things around that now is for a long time we've known that when Indigenous people make positive lifestyle changes in their life, they get a health benefit, but not the same as non-Indigenous people. So, you know, we improve our diet and do that regular exercise and do all those things that are good for us. So we'll get a small improvement, but if non-Indigenous people do the same, they get a bigger improvement. And, you know, people talk nonsense. They say, oh, it must be genetic, so, you know, what's the point in trying it? But now there's more and more research coming out, and it's about social value, you know, being valued socially and those kinds of things, and that how that contributes significantly to living the next 7-12 years and those kinds of things. And so if you pull all that together, as a younger man, I used to be asked, well, what are the 1, 2, or 3 things I can do to improve Aboriginal health? And I'd look at them, and if I thought, you're probably not someone who's going to get spirituality, community, wellness, community connection, and all those things. And if you didn't, then I felt a need to resort to the biomedical model. And I think about, you know, getting blood pressure under control and all those kinds of things. But, you know, now, with what I know now, I think the 3 things I'd do would be, the first thing would be stop racism. The second thing is stop racism. And, of course, you know what the third is. Because if you think about that, if you're insulted pretty much every day in your life for who you are and the race of your people, that has significant trauma impact on you. And these studies are now starting to show that if you don't have a strong social worth or you don't feel valued in society, you're not going to do as well. And I think that's where a lot of the answers are. And so that, you know, that comes back to stop colonising our people, because it's still happening today. I was talking at a research conference recently, and I just wanted people to have an understanding of how research has been used against us in the past, you know, like the old craniometry days, you know, measuring our skull size to say that we had inferior brains and stuff, which of course is not true. There were studies done on Aboriginal children, you know, asking them things like, oh, can you tell me your address, and in some, and those kinds of things, and some mathematics. Now, in some of the communities that they asked that, the houses didn't even have numbers and the streets didn't have names. So how could they answer that question? And then, you know, it wasn't for a thoughtful pediatrician who looked at the study design and said, oh, that's ridiculous. And he turned it around and he said to these groups of kids, like, well, okay, we're away from your house, point to where you live. And a lot of the non-Indigenous kids couldn't get that, or the city kids, and, you know, the other kids could. So it's about, you know, looking at that kind of stuff as it should be. And what I wanted to get to is that where we're still being colonised. So, you know, how some people are, and it's mostly Aboriginal people who are getting, if they're on government payments, like Centrelink and that kind of thing, it goes onto a card. That card can't be turned into cash, can't be used for alcohol, can't be used for gambling and those kinds of things. Now, we know that if you elect to have that, that works well for you. But when some outsider who doesn't even know you enforces that on you, it's further traumatising you. And this is what I said to the researchers, is what's going to happen is someone's going to look at alcohol-related crimes and going to go, oh, that's down, while they've enforced this on a particular region. They're going to look at alcohol-related hospital admissions and they're going to go, oh, see, this is a great thing, it works well. Without any understanding of the long-term effect, that they're still traumatising people. So the reason that people are doing that kind of behaviour is because they're stressed and they're traumatised and it hasn't been dealt with. And so by adding more trauma and more taking their life out of their control, out of their own hands, you're further exacerbating the problem, not fixing it. But the data, if you collect the right data, will look like it's working, but it's not.
100% agree with that, Peter. Taking that experience to what our medical students experience when they're coming in. I feel like when we see our patients, even as doctors, when we see patients that there is racist behaviour happening towards them, it affects us as doctors. And so when we have to tell our story, or as a medical student, there's often that expectation, you're Aboriginal, so you can be the teacher in this space when you're a medical student. And that's what I have a real problem with, is because And it might have changed. Hopefully it has changed since I was at university, but people are unsure of what they can say, like white fellows who might be teaching the education or, you know, standing by the side, and they don't want to say the wrong thing. So then you have to become, as the Indigenous person in the room, you have to become the expert because all your classmates look to you for guidance. What's the right thing I should be doing, or what's a resource I could be doing? And it puts more pressure on our students because they're just there to learn like everybody else, and they have to take on an additional burden of education that, A, they're not being compensated for, you know, and it's the emotional trauma of having to relive those things. And I found it quite difficult when we did do Aboriginal health components, say, in med school, because I found it upsetting because it was my people that they were talking about so coldly, and just the statistics, and look at the alcoholism, or look at this, or, you know, the casual racism. And it does affect you in a way. Like, I went through one of my exams, and there was a question there that was about, you know, the amount of alcohol. It was a hepatitis picture, alcoholic hepatitis. And of course, it was an Aboriginal person. I'm like, they didn't have to be an Aboriginal person. And it was like, when I knew where it was going, when I was asking the questions, I felt this sense of dread, and I felt this sense of like shame, and I felt angry. You know, as a student experiencing that, how are you supposed to pull yourself out of that to go on to the next, you know, the next room where I've got to be examined again? Just all those little things.
Thanks for bringing that example up. I mean, that's something that I talk about all the time. The example that I often use, you imagine you're a medical student on a ward round, there's an Aboriginal patient in the bed. You know, straight away there's a connection, and you know you need to advocate for that person. So let's assume that the boss is a bit of a racist and makes some racist comments. So that's going to flow down to the registrar, the junior doctor, and everyone else around. In a normal way that it does, you know, unless someone's solid enough to stand up. And so for that medical student, they need to stand up and make a comment. Now, you could say, oh, well, they have a choice not to. But we all know that if you didn't stand up for that, that's going to eat you up from the inside, and you're going to feel like you've compromised your integrity as a human being, your integrity as an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person. So you do have to stand up and you make a comment that, you know, that about the racism. And when you do that, now you're exposing yourself, because if this is a surgeon, for example, and you're thinking, I want a career in surgery, you're probably going to screw yourself over in terms of a career in surgery, because that person's going to say, oh, they're a bit feisty. You don't want them on your team, you know. And I use surgery as an example. It could be anything. And I suppose another part of what you point to is, and we talk to our tutors about not assuming that Indigenous people are the font of knowledge for all things Indigenous, our students, you know, and if they volunteer something, listen to that. But if they don't put them under pressure. And when you were talking about that, it made me think about a time when I was a registrar. An Aboriginal person was turning up to do some Aboriginal health stuff, and unfortunately, as is so often the case, they couldn't turn up because they had a loss in the family. And so as an Aboriginal man, I was asked to step in. And I was asked in a beautiful way. Like, I could have said no. It was a very safe environment for me. And my thought was, well, I don't know I've got much to offer, but yeah, I'll have a go at it. But then I reflected on that night, and I thought, well, you know, if I was there and maybe my mother or my father was a cardiologist, and the cardiologist didn't turn up to do the session on ECGs, they wouldn't ask me to do that.
Exactly.
So it is different for us in that sense, unfortunately. And, you know, as I say, you know, people might want to volunteer and they might have a whole knowledge set, but it's about a respectful communication. Just don't expect that to flow, because if someone doesn't feel safe, it's not going to flow.
And I think that there's a lot of unraveling of the cultures that need to be happening in medical spaces. So whether it's the hospital, or it's a GP practice, or it's a PHN or something like that. So somewhere where there is interface with patients. Because I think it's really important that, you know, doctors understand that there's often barriers of access to care for our patients when they come in. So it might be that even walking into the hospital makes them feel uncomfortable because they have a perception in the community that that's where you go to die, or their relative died there.
That was a struggle for me as a medical student, because I thought hospitals are where you go to die. And then when you go there into as a place of learning and know that there's healing there as well, that was a real challenge. You know, I think it's a very common one, actually.
So even like just walking through the door of a practice is a problem. And then the next barrier is, what are you meeting? Who are you seeing? Is there some place that makes you feel welcome? does it look like a white man's world? Or are you coming in, you can see your Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander flag? Can you see some artwork that makes you feel comfortable? Does the receptionist smile at you when you come in? You know, that's the next barrier. Because doctors might say, oh, these people, we keep making appointments for their clinic and they don't turn up. But there's a lot of reasons why people don't turn up behind that missed appointment that we have to reflect on as a culture of medicine, that we have to examine each of these different layers. So it's not just the doctor or the consultant or whoever who has a bit of a racist attitude or is deeply embedded in this colonialism or the patriarchal paternalistic mindset. It's walking through the door. What am I experiencing? Can I even get to the hospital? Have I got someone to look after my kids? Are my kids safe that I can actually come in? Have I got money to catch a bus? So, you know, there's steps before. So a lot of people just go, oh, well, they're just write them off, you know, they're not here, fail to attend.
It's about changing that lens, isn't it? Sometimes talk about this on our area health service in this region. I've managed to have some communication and get people to review the DAMA, the discharge against medical advice, often from the department, you know, and to change that lens. So, you know, we've all got so many of these stories, but I think about one in particular. It was a gentleman coming to the clinic, Aboriginal man, was having chest pain, and clearly he was having an infarct, you know. So done what we could at the scene, got him in the ambulance, and he goes into the emergency department and he's happy to have treatment. You know, he's in there. He knows that if he doesn't, how bad it could be, he knows what's going on. At some point, he pulls his ECG leads off, pulls his drip line out and says, I'm walking out the door. And as what the staff do is, oh, we advise you not to go, and then you still want to go. So it's like we wash our hands of that. It's your responsibility now. But our responsibility is in the area where what is it that this man was happy to come into this building and have treatment, but this building and the people in it, or some of the people in it, are so toxic that now he's prepared to risk his life and walk out the front door rather than stay in this toxicity. That's our responsibility. That's not the patient's responsibility, you know. And, you know, one of our friends, Tim Senior, he has a quote that I absolutely love. And it's around when, you know, we talk about compliance all the time. Oh, but as doctors, oh, the patient wasn't compliant with their treatment or their medicines. And what Tim said is that for him, that means the patient didn't take my brilliant advice, because we think we've got brilliant advice. And then here's the important bit, and I can't be bothered to find out why. Because, you know, that's when we wash our hands. Oh, they weren't compliant. That's their stuff. Well,
they signed their form. Legally discharged my responsibility.
Yeah, or even like with a medicine as a GP, why didn't the patient take that? Could they afford it? Did they read the back of it and go, hey, that looks dangerous? You know, even if you look at aspirin, the thing that comes with it, you think, oh, I don't want to take that. And it's a simple, commonly used medicine, you know. And I've even had the same kind of thing. You know, a long time ago, I had a young lady who had a respiratory infection. Talked to her all about the medicine and everything. And I said to her, you know, are you going to be right to get this? Because that's back in the days when we used to pull out, you know, $20 ourselves and make sure the patient could get the medicine. And she said, yeah, I'll be fine to get that, you know, paydays today or something. What happened is there was a delay in her pay going in, and she was a single mum with a few little ones. And then she came back a week later, but I didn't know about the delay in the pay. She came back a week later and her infection was worse, and we talked about it, and she didn't get the medicine because she didn't get paid on time, or she didn't get paid. There was a hold up and she still hadn't been paid when I seen her. And for her, it was like, well, I can feed the kids or I can get the medicine. She's going to feed the kids every night. So if you don't have that kind of relationship with your patients, you don't find that out. And if you don't ask those questions because you think, oh, non-compliant patients, stereotyping and, you know, that kind of stuff, you're just not going to be a good doctor.
I can just imagine the notes people type, you know, patient instructed to take medication, warned about potential dangers, blah, 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 done. You know, script, here you go. I think you're right. There has to be a whole lens change. And part of that lens change that I really love, because it's so heartfelt for me and resonant for me, and I know it is for you, Peter, as well, is the link to the spirituality and link to the nunkery. When I was saying at the start of this podcast that I went out to Alice Springs as my, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young doctor. When I came into medicine, the other experience I had before then, I was a healer. So I was able to see spirit. My hands would get hot. I could travel into people's bodies, as it is with our culture. But I didn't have any particular formal training in that. Like, we didn't go through initiation. It happened in my dreams. So when I went out to Alice Springs, these two old gentlemen were sitting up on the stage with an interpreter, and I'm sitting there minding my own business, looking around at all these amazing doctors. And then these two old men started talking, and I sat upright and I was mesmerized. I was transfixed by what they were saying, because they were talking about doing things that I could do. And to see the doctors stand up at the end and give them the applause, I was so emotional. Because when I started med school, apart from me feeling like I was at the Top Gun Academy, a lecturer came out and said, if you believe in homeopathy, you might as well leave now. That was his basic open statement. The line was drawn in the sand, and someone like me, with my healing and my experiences, was not allowed in medicine. So I shrunk. And then that's when my anxiety, and I went, fuck, I don't belong here. But Jesus, look at all these guys. I'm not smart enough. It blossomed again when I met them old men and saw the response from the Indigenous doctors, everyone standing up. I made a special space for these old men, and for us to acknowledge that the traditional healing ways was our doctors. They were doctors. We saw that despite they didn't go through that Western medicine model, that they had 60,000 years of Indigenous knowledge, in a way, evidence-based. And it blew my mind. I remember going up to them afterwards. I'd like to say I did pretty, you know, that movie style, like real pretty crying, like we get a little gentle tear, like dropping out. It was ugly. I probably had a bit of snot. And I was just so emotional, because I'm trying to explain to them, like, thank you, and you're like me, because I knew nobody like me. So that was why they were just so important in my life, Peter. And I know that they are equally important in yours.
Absolutely. When I think of, reflect back on my life, some of the most special things are the amazing people that I've met. And those old men, are certainly, it's hard to talk about them without, I know both of us, without getting upset, because they were so important to us and had such an important place in our heart. And as you're talking about the acceptance, amongst our mob, of those old men and the value we held them in. I always remember all the doctors lining up to get healing off them. everyone would be lined up. Oh, I've got this problem, and they'd fix it for people, that different way of thinking. So again, that imposter syndrome is increased, because you're thinking, people here don't think like me, when you're in medical school. But when you find that space and those amazing people, and I reflect on them for so many things, and sometimes when I, not so much now with the work I do, but as a new junior doctor, and you're working hard, you're working long hours, people complaining, oh, we work too hard, we don't get paid. And I think that those old men and those old ladies will do the same. And they're on call 24/7. They don't get paid, but they do it because of the responsibility and the gift that they've been given to be able to heal other people and look after their community. And so I think it helps keep you humble and keeps the humility level there when you reflect on who they are. And just even just to be in their presence. There was one of them who I'm friends with, both of them, and love them dearly, both dearly. And one of them I just sort of connected to in a bit of a stronger way, but I took me so long to talk to him because I didn't feel like I was worthy of having a conversation with him. Held him up, so high. And then in their beautiful nature, and I think he could tell that, and he just made me feel at home and comfortable and valued in the loving way that they do.
And I love that they provided opportunity for us at a conference to go out and sit with them under a tree, and sit down and have a yarn with them, and they'd teach us stuff, or teach us a song or a dance, or you could just go and, it was just amazing. Like, they were just so good. Now, you're telling a story once, I'll get you to try and recall it, but when about one of them snoring, and were they doing something?
I was actually just going to talk about that again too, because it's the connection I think of all the time. So when AIDA moved into Old Parliament House, we acknowledged that there were decisions that were made in that building that weren't good for us, good for our people. They were made against our people. And, we'd been in there for a little while, and even some of the staff in there had felt that it just didn't feel good. They felt that there's some bad spirits there. And so those old men couldn't smoke the building because it's heritage listed and all these kinds of reasons, but they did another form of cleansing. And I was really honoured to be able to go with them when they did that. And part of what they were doing was taking the bad spirits away and leaving the good spirits, because they're spirits of people who wanted to make a difference, who were just, good people. So they left them there as well. And I could see it was really physically and emotionally taxing on them to do this, as you would expect it would be. So after we'd gone through all their work. We went up to finish it off in the section that AIDA was in, and we're sitting there in a room, and one of the old men falls asleep because he was drained. And you could just see that work that he'd put into this, you know. And then Uncle's there sitting there telling me about all those little things that they did and what they mean and how they do them. And I'm just in awe. I'm just intensely listening. And then he says, "And if that doesn't get rid of the evil spirits, Rupert's snoring and scare anyone away." And just like my uncle, here I am. And that humour just comes through, and I just think, oh. And at that point, we all looked across, and he's there. It was a beautiful moment. But for me, it was just like, you know, this Indigenous sort of sense of humour is the same everywhere, isn't it? You know, that serious conversation and all that great knowledge that gets imparted, and then you just got to finish it with something that's funny and connects you again, you know?
Yeah, it's sort of like brings us back to that full circle, and it's almost like the laughter. You know, if I talk about ceremonies and stuff like that, you've got to have something to seal in the energy, and having a laugh can sometimes do that, I think, sort of finishes off the, you know, whatever it is, that energy work you've been doing. I do adore those old men and think about them very, very often. And you yourself, you're one of my, besides my husband, you're one of my favorite men, because what I loved about you is that your connection to your family and your love for your family and just being a solid man who supports women, advocates for those whose voice might be quiet, or, you know, those people who need your support, and you lend your strength to help people. And it made me think about this cartoon that I saw, I think it was back in 2016, and it was a Bill Leake cartoon. It was about a drunk Aboriginal man who was holding a beer, and he couldn't remember his son's name as the Indigenous police officer was, you know, holding his collar. And it caused such an, like, that was okay. You know, like, that's what gets me, is that this understanding of an Aboriginal male is someone who's drunk and doesn't know who their kids are. And I just find it so offensive, because there are good men in community, and I'm so sick of seeing them being demonised.
It's absolutely heartbreaking, isn't it, to think that our men would be portrayed like that. Just link it back to the real men that I know. You know, I've worked for a particular community, because I don't want to identify these men, for over 20 years, and I really feel blessed to be brought in and feel part of that community. When the Northern Territory emergency, so-called emergency intervention occurred, you know, a lot of our men were tarred with a brush to say that we all were drunks, bashed our wives, and abused children, you know. And so I had at least two men come in, and I'm very confident that they didn't know each other, that they knew each other, but they didn't know that this was going on for each other. And as a doctor, you're in a privileged position to know what's going on. So they both came to see me at separate times with the same thing, and this is what gets me. So they both had, you know, what I would determine an exogenous depression, a depression that comes about from factors outside of your environment that causes the changes in the neurotransmitters. The story was almost exactly the same. But they were saying to me, like, when I walk down the street, I feel like I'm being judged as an Aboriginal man. I feel like people are now looking at me thinking I must be drunk, I must bash my wife, and I must, you know, molest children. This is the strength of these men, you know. And they both said at the individual times that I can't point out enough, said, you know, I can sort of take that for me, but what broke their heart is that they know good Aboriginal men who they look up to and respect and love, who were being tarred with that brush. And for me, that's just totally selfless. You know, they can put up with being looked at in that way themselves, even though they were both amazing men, but they had so much love for their community and other people in the community, which was they held in higher regard than themselves, and that's what hurt them.
And it's the role modelling for young men coming through, young boys. And when all of that stuff, like the paedophilia stuff in communities, was coming out, I think I was up on Thursday Island, and we were doing a croc fest, and this was back in the day when they used to do those. And so I think I was a student at the time, but there were these young boys, and we had those little dolls that would, you know, they could wee and poo, and you had to like feed them at certain times. They were like little mechanical babies. That's how you learn to look after a baby. And they could not put that baby down. And they were all hugging this little baby, and they were going, "Nah, nah, little baby." And the baby started crying. They're laughing, going, "Oh, that baby needs some susu, like some breast milk. So I give it the boob, some susu." And, you know, they were doing that. And it was just so lovely for me to see. But it's also heartbreaking to say, you are so innocent right now, you young boys, and I can see your kindness and compassion and your love. But then when you grow older, that society will be looking at you in a particular way.
It is really hard, isn't it? I often talk about cultural solutions, and let's look at domestic violence, for example, and it's usually portrayed against ladies. And it's a problem for the whole country and for the whole world. It's not just for Aboriginal people. I judge our men a little bit more harshly probably than I do other men because of our responsibility and our connectedness and connection to culture. But I do understand that the colonisation process has distanced us so much from that. So some people might not have that.
I think it's actually like a disconnect from our warrior. So if we talk about epigenetics and genetics, like you yourself, Peter, at the very start of this, you said when you had your back pain that if you weren't doing your physical exercise, you were getting angry because that was a way that you were able to cope. Because if you look at our ancestral lineage, our men were out hunting and, you know, using their physicality and being physical. And so we're in a space today where we're not being that way. But also being a warrior is being, you know, taking the food last, letting the weakest people, you know, making sure that they're fed, looking after the women, the older women, the sick, and the poor. And that's what I think the warrior is. So that's what I think I love when I look at people like yourself and even the uncles in a way, like, you know, they're older warriors now, but it's that love and connection and caring for people with strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what I wanted to get to, I'm talking about the domestic violence across the country, and, you know, and unfortunately it does affect our communities as well. But we had a cultural solution for that. And colonisation has taken that away. So, you know, for my mob, and I know for many mobs across the country, but I can't speak for all of them, you know, the young men until around the age of 15 would spend all their time with the ladies, you know, the majority of their time with the ladies. And so you learn to love, honour and respect women so much that you couldn't possibly raise your hand to them. And part of that was to teach young men too that our women will think about problems in a different way and they will have different solutions. And you need to listen to that because you can't come up with that answer yourself, you know. And then, of course, you know, around the age of 15, they would start to move more to spend time with the men and look at ceremony and those kinds of things. And that was a cultural solution, but, you know, colonisation has taken that away, taken off our land. You know, we couldn't put on a small parcel of land, couldn't talk our stories, couldn't sing our songs, couldn't engage in culture.
And that's right. And then, you can just see the flow-on effects of that, the loss of our culture and how it's led to trauma and led to the racism and led to our poor health, our poor mental health. And it's, you know, it's the disconnect from our land and from our the great mother. You know, like we used to have practices that made us connect with the earth in such a profound way. And we used to have ceremonies to honour the passing of time, like the solstice or when it was turning into winter. There were things that we knew, but we've just become so disconnected from that because of modernisation and colonisation. And I love that there's a whole movement back to reconnecting with the earth and with the men. I was on a course recently and there was another man that I'll be getting on the podcast later on. And he was beautiful because the first day, that we're all women, he was the only fella on the course, and he just listened the whole day. And that was part of his cultural law, is that women speak first. And so he was just quiet and listened. And then even when we were doing the practice, we had to, you know, he was supporting us the whole way through. It was just so beautiful to have that sort of strength there, you know, supporting you.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you point out so well that when we talk about our warriors, it's not what is the first thing that comes to mind to many people. It's not about violence and fighting. It's about being strong. You know, Aboriginal men with kiddies, you know, and I remember my uncles as a kid, every time I would see them, their face would light up with excitement and it made me feel so valued. You know, I know I do that now when I was in this community building the other day, and this gentleman walked in with this holding this little baby facing it out, and I've got all excited and I'm waving, and this guy's looking at me thinking, this bloke's a nut. But it's like, I see the baby, you know. And also, you know, thinking about that, putting that warrior into perspective too, My nan's brother was an amazing man for me. He's the guy who taught me how to box, and like my uncles, because I never had a dad, you know, taught me how to be a man, a proper man. There were some men who weren't so good around in my life, and I used to wonder why they were so scared of this uncle of mine. They were terrified of him, you know. And for me, like, this is the most loving man I could ever meet. I just couldn't link that up. But I know later on that he had a cultural responsibility that when men were doing the wrong thing, he would have to fix that. Sorry, I'm getting a bit choked up. So as a man to go into battle, he's not someone you'd want to battle. But I used to think, how would they ever be scared of this man? He's just so beautiful and kind, you know. And yeah, that's our warriors.
Oh, darling, I'm looking at your face. I'll tell you a funny story now just to like seal in this energy, this beautiful warrior energy. So a mutual friend of ours was telling me she had a patient come in a bit down, and she's like, are you all right? What's going on? And he's like, oh, I'm just real tired. And she's like, oh, what's going on, you know, blah, blah, blah. He goes, oh, my missus has started reading that 50 Shades of Grey book. She's proper wearing me out.
He's standing up to be what's right in more ways than one.
Peter, as always, it's so lovely to speak with you. I've really enjoyed our time. Have you got 3 top tips? I know that you mentioned racism before, but for our doctors and healthcare workers, how they can improve their practice when they're interacting with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients.
Be genuine, because our mob have got really good bullshit detectors. Be respectful in your approach. And if you be respectful in your approach, I often talk about to students when you go into a community. If you have genuine interest in the community and the history of the community and those kinds of things, and you ask those questions in a respectful, kind way, people will really engage. They'll love the fact that you're interested. And you'll get so much out of it. It'll enrich your life, and you'll be able, as a practitioner, you'll be able to do so much more. So I think it's about those kinds of things. Be genuine and be respectful. And, you know, it's something I thought of yesterday when I closed a meeting of people across the country. It was a Zoom one, and I just thought, especially in these times, you know, make sure all the people that we love know that we love them. I know that's a sort of age-old thing with history, but there's a point where you just think, I've lost all my uncles now, and my auntie, who was so important to me as well, and although I spent a lot of time with them, and then I reflect back on it now, I think it just wasn't, it's never going to be enough.
It's never enough.
Yeah. So I really, really value that kind of stuff. But I think for people working in our community, be genuine and be respectful and be open. Open your mind to what people might say and reflect on that. I think, you know, there was a period of time where sometime ago, and I was asked within an organisation to reflect on evaluating the contribution that elders bring. And I thought, I don't know how you can do that, because I might be with an elder and I have a conversation and I walk away thinking, oh, that was really important. I've got that. I know what they mean. And then 18 months later, I reflect on that same conversation and go, no, it's much more deeper than that. How can you evaluate that kind of thing? I don't think you can. You're lucky enough to hear those pearls of wisdom, then really value that.
I know. I think, like with my grandmother, with her passing, I just wish I knew more, or I wish I sat down. You know, we always have those regrets, but, you know, we wish we sat down with a tape recorder and recorded her stories and her thoughts. And it's sad, because with the, you know, time, you forget those sorts of things. So on that note, Peter, thank you so much for joining us again. The third time's a charm for us. We've had a few Wi-Fi issues and recording issues. So you're a difficult man to like reschedule, because you're so busy and doing such amazing work in the world. So I appreciate you, Peter, and I love the work that you're doing in the world.
Thank you, sister. And of course, I love you and your family. And I'm really honoured to be here. Friends of mine talk about your podcasts, and I have a real sense of pride, and it just comes out a little bit more. I'm a bit chuffed to think that's my sister there. So thank you, and I'm going to have a great day from having spoken to you this morning as well.
Thank you, darling. Take care. See you. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks for listening to Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Please subscribe to the podcast and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.